Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. I'm pleased to be in the garden, though sadly only virtually this week, with Max Cotton. Max was a political reporter in Westminster for the BBC since 1995. He then left politics in 2012. He lives on a small holding in the southwest near Glastonbury. Max caught my attention due to his BBC Radio 4 series, which followed him living totally from his abandoned small holding of 2 hectares or 5 acres, starting in September 22 for 12 months. That year was spent being pretty much 100% self-sufficient. The only edible bought-in commodity was salt. He could not even fish the streams. Max, lovely to be with you here. What was your first meal post your self-sufficiency?
Bakewell tart. I had a sort of obsession. My son Jack is at university in Sheffield, and I drove him up to university and I had to go through Bakewell. And I was suddenly, oh my goodness me, I'd like a Bakewell tart. And that was right at the beginning of the project. And so I had this obsession about Bakewell tart. So a friend of mine, Rose, who runs a little cafe here in Somerset, made me a Bakewell tart. And I ate some Bakewell tart. I have to say, it was so sweet, sickly, sickly sweet. It actually made my teeth vibrate as I was eating it because it was so incredibly sweet.
But so I always think if you cut out sugar from your diet and then you eat it after a period, it you almost don't like sugar. And when you taste pure sugar like that, it is almost repellent. Did you find that? Did it change your taste buds?
It really, really did. And also not just things like cakes and stuff, but shop-bought bread is incredibly sweet. If you've had a year of eating bread which you've just made from yeast and flour and water and salt, as I did, you discover just how much sugar there is in shop-bought bread. And it's sickly sweet bread, I find. My taste buds really, really changed.
So from that, it was a beneficial thing to do, would you say? From that point alone, the lack of sugar. But you did have honey, which is way sweeter than sugar.
Yeah, but I wasn't putting honey in. I wasn't putting honey in bread. And the other thing is that honey is great. And yes, I had. I didn't run out of honey. I had easily enough honey to last me. But if you put honey in anything, it just tastes of honey. So I made some jam. I made some chutney, which was where the portion of sugar was replaced by honey. And all you have is jam that tastes of honey and preserves that taste of honey. Yeah, chutney tastes of honey if you sweeten it with honey. And right. So I didn't, it was nice eating honey. I like honey, but I didn't. The reason why I didn't run out anything like of honey was because I didn't want to everything I ate that wasn't, really savoury. To taste of honey.
Right, okay. So you stopped being a political journalist in 2012. Why did you change? And then what did you do from then to now, really?
So I didn't want to... What was I, 2012? I was nearly 50. And I just thought, you know what? I want to do something else. I want to do something that's really challenging. For me, my life talking for a living as a political correspondent was something that came very, very easily to me because I inherited lots of brilliant communication skills from my parents. I didn't find it particularly challenging and I wanted to really, really challenge myself. So I left the BBC. I wanted to do something about food. I started a growing very chaotically. I started a farm shop, which I ran here in our village unsuccessfully. That had to close because I was losing so much money. I did bits and pieces of extras work, all sorts of other bits and bobs, just sort of living really.
So were your
but yeah,
parents German?
I ran a farm shop business, more or less
Right.
straight after I left the BBC,
Yeah.
For 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. But to go into retailing with no experience, I mean, you say it wasn't a success, but I often think that lots of people think, oh, I'd love to run a pub, I'd love to run a hotel, love to run a shop. But all these disciplines are actually pretty difficult to get right, don't they? And it's a sort
Totally.
of dream of people, but you really need to sort, you know, do business plans and all this stuff. And it's not an easy way to
Yeah.
change. No.
Yeah. No, you need a not an eye for detail. You need an obsession for detail. And I am Mr. Broad Brush, hang it
Yeah.
on a wall and see how it goes sort of person. I definitely didn't have the right temperament. I worked unbelievably hard, but I definitely
Yeah.
didn't have the right temperament for doing that, that's for sure.
When you said your parents were good communicators, I mean, you obviously are yourself a fabulous communicator, but so were they journalists or what disciplines were they?
Dad, mum was a educational psychologist, teacher trainer. She had about 4 or 5 degrees. She worked in teacher training mainly, teaching teachers in at university level, really lecturers and stuff.
Yeah.
My dad was a chartered surveyor, who was a frustrated politician. Dad was leader of Kingston Council when I was a kid, and desperately wanted to be a member of parliament. Norman Lamont actually became the member of parliament when a man called John Boyd Carpenter retired from being the MP for Kingston, and Dad really wanted to be the MP in Kingston, and. Well, the story goes that my mum wouldn't let him. But Norman Lamont became the Member of Parliament for Kingston. And thus a little page of British political history was written.
Oh, right. I see. So now you live with your wife, Maxine, who you referred to as Mrs. Max. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
She's Max. She's Max Cotton. And I'm
Yeah.
Max Cotton. And so... We call each other and everyone else calls her and me, Mr. and Mrs. Max. I mean, it sounds awful, doesn't it? Like she's some sort of extension of myself when people refer to her as Mrs. Max, but we're both Max Cottons.
Yeah, no, I think it's fine. I'm happy with that. And then you have 24 hens, 2 cows, 2 pigs and 6 sons. I've watched a lot of your year on YouTube and I have to say, they were fantastically shot, fantastically produced. They're really compelling little videos, aren't they? Really good. And I just wondered, well, one of my first things from seeing those YouTube videos was you never eat together. Now, was that just because it was impossible to film you eating together? Because you'd all be talking 10 to the dozen and it would be totally disruptive to listen to and watch. Or was it because you didn't want to sit down to your spinach and whatever while they were tucking into, you know, Yorkshire pudding, tomato ketchup and all those things that you couldn't eat?
Yeah. So I wasn't at all fussed that they were able to eat things that I wasn't able to eat. I was on a mission and nothing was going to distract me. So that wasn't the case. Mrs. Max didn't want to be on the telly, so she didn't particularly want to be filmed. And
I
also,
assumed that.
I was eating twice a day, at about sort of 9:30 or 10 o'clock and about probably about 5:30. None of my children are up at 9:30 without exception in the morning. And in the evening, they were kind of doing their own thing. And most of the time for an evening meal, I was eating something that had already been prepared. So what I'd do is I'd make 12 shepherd's pies and 10 veggie chilies and stuff like that. And most of the time, because I was so busy, I was working to earn money, but I was also having to pick everything, wash all the soil off things, cook things, prepare things. It takes an enormous amount of time. And so I was in a hurry a lot of the time. So I was eating stuff that I'd prepared earlier, mainly. We so did you... have Sunday lunch. We did have Sunday lunch together every week. It was more or less a broadly food self-sufficient lunch.
But I get the impression you're quite a close family from the videos and things. So normally you would eat together. That must have been quite a sacrifice to have to eat on your own most of the time.
Not really. I mean, we're an amazingly close family.
Yeah.
But I don't recall it being a terrible sacrifice.
Okay.
Not really.
But one thing you just said then has really raised my query level, because you said shepherd's pie. You haven't got any sheep. You mean cottage pie.
The whole snobbery attached to what is a cottage pie and what is a shepherd's pie just doesn't... So I don't sort of register with that. Fine. If it's got to have mutton in it, it's a shepherd's pie. And if it's got beef mince in it, it's a cottage pie. Fine.
I thought that's not snobbery. I just thought that's what they were. I thought that was the definition of a shepherd's pie.
I'm not accusing you of snobbery at all. I'm just... My butcher does exactly the same to me. Oh, you know, so I've got to make some shepherd's pies. And he says, oh, well, you know, need some mutton. And I'm like, oh, okay, fine. I just was always brought up, the shepherd's pie was a pie made with potato on the top and more or less anything underneath.
Well, I'm afraid that was a bit lax, that definition. Anyway, the other thing from that is, why did you not approach a TV company to do this following this year? Because I thought it was riveting and I thought it would make great telly. Or did you want to go it alone and do it on your own? And the girl who filmed, did she film on a little phone or was it a proper camera? Because it all looks professional. And the music by your son, Henry Cotton, I just thought the whole thing looked done so well, and I would have thought it would have been a great hit series.
So the filming and the editing was done by a woman called Tessa Brown, who I met in a bar in Castle Carey.
Yes.
And she and I got on together like a house on fire. She was a postgraduate documentary film student who was kind of kicking her heels, and we just got on terribly, terribly well together. And she was generous enough to give 2 years of her life to making these films. And she's incredibly talented, not just in terms of filming and editing. And I say that from a professional point of view. I am a filmmaker. I've made squillions of films for the BBC. I'm really, really good at it. And she is just exceptional. But she also really got this project. There's something really subversive about the whole project. There's something pioneering about it. And she really, really bought into all of that. And we became massively firm friends. And she just kind of slotted into our family and became a sort of daughter between sons number two and son number three. And she's just great. And Tess, what a star. Have been an amazing, amazing person to meet and work with.
I loved it when you said to one of your sons when you were filming, now stop flirting with Tess and get on and do that. And he replied, you're always flirting with her. That's hilarious.
That's professional jealousy. No, we all got on brilliantly well.
I got that definitely. And she must have learned a lot from you, actually, to spend a couple of years working with you. She's obviously got her benefit from it too, but you didn't approach a major TV company to do it. That's my point.
I don't know why we didn't want to. I think that the idea of, it's not just approaching, you know, if I had gone along to a production company or Channel 4 or the BBC and said, I want to make this film, and they had said, yeah, definitely, I wouldn't have had any editorial control over it. That would have been in the hands of the producer and the director and the BBC, say, or Channel 4, whoever it was. Tess wouldn't have got to film it. Tess wouldn't have got to produce it, and we wanted it to be our project. We weren't in it for making money. We weren't in it to be. Look, I left the BBC because I wanted to stop making films, not to start making films. And so we want the project had to kind of come first, and that's why we made the decision to put it out on YouTube. I mean, look, is it a disappointment that it hasn't been bigger on YouTube? Absolutely it is. You know, we've got hardly anyone seen our YouTube films. And that's been a shame. It's been made up for the fact that the BBC, what a wonderful organization it is. The BBC said, look, we want to make this radio series about this, and they took it on board and ran with it brilliantly. And so it's been great, but I think it would have been just awful. I mean, apart from anything else, the idea of having a film crew in my home for a whole year, no way. Do you know what I mean? It would have become a kind of reality TV thing where we're constantly trying to make Mrs. Max cry. No.
And you have to have all that jeopardy, don't you? They won't film anything that doesn't have jeopardy. So you'd be on the point of starvation, and then, you know, it all gets
That's
so
right.
And it,
yeah. Yeah.
Unreal. No. Absolutely. Yeah. So I love the way when you said, I wanted a plain pastoral existence that a chap in Saxon England would recognise for its stoic simplicity of purpose. And then at the end of the year, you said you didn't want the year to end as it defined you. And it is interesting the way that we do feel better when we are defined. And that was really a fabulous way to be defined, isn't it, by that year? Because I think anyone hearing about that would think, what? Did he really? But that mustn't be the thing that's most defined you in your life so far. What do you think it probably is?
There are lots of things that are terribly important to me, over and above food self-sufficiency and growing my own carrots and killing my own turkeys. Look, you can't have six sons and a daughter and for that not to be your magnum opus. So there are, you know, there are lots of things that that are very, very important to me. I think that what is it? Was it a play? Oh, What a Lovely War. Was that a play?
Yeah, I think
first
it was
of all?
A play. Yeah. 70s
so
or something. Yeah.
That as a phrase, I can't remember what it was actually about, but as a phrase, that kind of defines my year of food self-sufficiency, because was it easy? No. Was it something that took over the whole of my life to the exclusion of all sorts of things? Yes. Was it hard and painful? Yes. But my goodness, the sense of purpose and the sense of camaraderie and the sense of having meaning in my life that connected me with nature, being a real person, was incredibly important. Edmund, son number two, at the beginning, when Tess was interviewing him, Edmund said, everything we have in life is given to us by something else, someone else. I mean, we had to pay for it, but every single thing we are reliant on other people for. And I desperately wanted to look after myself for a whole year and not be going cap in hand to some sort of multinational company to try and, you know, to try and keep myself alive. I find that so disempowering. I mean, William Cobbett, who's an enormous hero of mine, I'm sure most of your listeners will have some recollection of who he is. He was an early 19th century journalist, member of parliament, pain in the neck, campaigner. He actually started Hansard, various other things. He was the first person, right in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, to point out how incredibly disempowering industrialization was and how it was taking away so much of the meaning and so much of the spirit of human existence in England. And I think that all I was doing was feeling the pressure of that times, 500, because because we're so much more dependent on others around us in our capitalist system than we were in the 1815s. I had to address that personally for myself. I had to do something about it. This feeling that I wasn't responsible for anything. You know, I had to go and ask someone else for something. You know, how do I get around? I drive around the car made by Renault, petrol produced by ExxonMobil, tire rubber from blah, you know, all my clothes manufactured by, you know, there was at no point in Max's life was Max actually looking after himself. And I just wanted to spend a year trying to address that.
Yeah, William Cobbett's best known probably as author of Cottage Economy. And he reckoned in the early 18th century that a quarter of an acre could feed a large family. Yeah. And that is extraordinary, isn't it? And his whole ethos was he wanted to help the poor to feed themselves. And I almost wondered if your motives were similar, that you're the 21st century William Cobbett, and you're just maybe thinking we should all think a bit more about this. That was my take on your attachment to him. But
yeah,
I think it's a very, very good motive, really, isn't it? It is a fascinating thing to do. But you had grown veg before you started this, but you just did it for fun. And it obviously concerned you that Britain couldn't feed itself. And do you think that maybe also part of this whole business was that you think there might be a massive cyber attack or something that would cause chaos in the food chain? And we're so removed from that chap in Saxon England that we are totally vulnerable and that it all could collapse, especially after COVID, when we suddenly realised we were pretty frail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't put it better myself. I mean, I do have a sort of... this is going to come out wrong, buddy. This is so going to come out wrong. I do have a slight admiration for the crazy North American prepper with his knives and his buckskin and his rifles in a compound somewhere waiting for the apocalypse. I do sort of admire that, you know, pre-apocalypse kind of planning thing slightly. There was a brilliant Terry Nation 1975 TV serial called Survivors, which some of your listeners may remember, where...
And it was some bomb or something, wasn't it?
Hideous bug takes over, kills 99.999% of the population, and everyone's left on their own to try and deal with it.
Yeah.
And the point you're making about this, the COVID thing, is all bets are off. You know, I mean, if we, you know, ultimately, we're not just reliant on industrialization, as William Cobbett was railing against. We're now reliant on the internet. I mean, life would literally collapse without the internet, or, you know, Britain would be bankrupt without it in just whatever 15 years. And so this ties into the whole of that self-reliant thing. But also, you know, let's not get away from the fact that the chief motivation for me doing this was because I didn't like living on a small holding for 20 years, all of the different food projects I've had going on here, my farm shop, my Christmas turkeys, all of those things I've done have only ever been for fun and growing all my veg has only ever been for fun because... At the end of the day, nothing was at stake. I was always earning enough money to go and buy food in the supermarket. And so I was just doing it for my own pleasure. This is very, very controversial. Britain is farming for fun. And it's very, very difficult to get our heads around. But we are such a rich country and the amount of food that we use is so cheap in comparison with the wealth of our country. We don't need to farm at all. We could just buy in all the food we need. We could export all of our agriculture and just buy in all the food we need. Jeremy Clarkson has done an enormously brilliant job at highlighting issues about food and farming with his Clarkson farm thing. He took a £10 million asset, his farm, decided he was going to go and start farming it. And after farming it for a year, he made 145 quid. Nothing gets you kicked out of business school faster than taking £10 million, using it for a year and making £145. And the point is that people aren't making any money here. We are, you know, farming is this sort of adjunct, which is controlled by the price of property, not by the price of food. And it's in a terrible, terrible mess. And we really, really need to do something about it.
But food. That, a lot of that is the fault of the government. I mean, if Clarkson had put his farm down for rewilding, the whole lot, the grants that he would get from that would be far more than the £145 that he earned, and he'd be sitting in his deck chair, which to my mind seems completely bonkers.
Crazy.
And the last the things that the government announced just this week, wasn't it? So that was the thing that Rishi Sunak said. We haven't got enough labourers to go and pick their food in the field, so let's get all the people who are unemployed or suffering from unhealth to go and pick the food. Which, as Guy Singh Watson put it, you know, there's no way you can get any British person to go out picking, lifting potatoes or whatever by hand, because they just don't do it. It's hard work, it's cold, and there's no way they would want to. And all the people that go and work on the field doing manual labour are people from places like Poland and Lithuania who perhaps are manual workers, and the Brits just don't want to do it. And the other thing they announced this week, which completely made my hair stand on end, was that the class queue, you know, where you can convert a barn, at the moment you can convert a barn into 5 dwellings with no planning permission, they've just changed it. You can do it to 10 dwellings with no planning permission. So the price of all these little barns all over the countryside are going to come out of the farmers. They will not be able to pay for the amount that it's going to get. They're going to get for development. So there's a whole more raft of land coming out of production and into these people who want to go and live in the countryside and not contribute to producing food. And the whole farming and grant system seems to me completely bonkers, as you say. And we are, because we could be reliant on imports, they're doing this, but we don't know what's going to happen.
I mean, it's not just the kind of, oh, we don't bother to produce our own food. We've got some little chap in Africa some terribly nice people we know in southern Spain make our food, you know, and we don't bother with that. We just sign the check. It's absolutely appalling. A country that can't feed itself is in desperate trouble in all sorts of different directions, as far as I'm concerned. And food is so ludicrously cheap. The price of food needs to go sky high, and the price and people can't afford that. And so we've got to address the fact that in the last 40 years, the price of food has halved in as a proportion of family income, and the price of housing has doubled. And we do have a cost of living crisis. It's got nothing to do with food. The cost of the wheat in a loaf of bread is threepence. The cost of the chicken and vegetables in this can of Heinz soup is 9p. It costs £2 in Asda, and the cost of the food is 9p. You can feed Britain on the profits of Unilever. That's after you've paid the hundreds of thousands of people who work for Unilever. You could feed Britain on the profits that Unilever make. Mm. Food is not expensive. Capitalism is expensive. Our homes, which is a reflection of capitalism, are expensive. And food is so ludicrously cheap. It's being used as something to make money out of us in this absolutely appalling way. 66% of adolescents in Britain have 60% of their diet comes from ultra processed food. Mm. And it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. We are damaging our health. We are enslaving ourselves in debt. to allow people to make a profit so they can offer us a job so we can work to earn enough money to buy the food they're making for us. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
There is a big lobby against this, isn't it? Michael Mosley, Jamie Oliver, they're all getting together, and the two twins are into it, to try and stop this. But it is a massive movement. And I was, one of our clients is a big food scientist and employs, I don't turn over 60 million, and his whole life has been spent persuading people to buy these things. And I said to him, if you were working for the other camp, how would you do it? Because the problem with this ultra processed food is it gives you a big instant hit. It's bad for you, but you have a bit and you want more and you can't stop eating it. And he said the way you do them is you'd say that the reward you get from saying no to instant food is just that you will get delayed reward. So when you haven't had it, an hour later, you think, thank God I didn't eat that dreadful thing, which was bad for my system, bad for my weight, unhealthy, expensive. But I think that's a really difficult thing to get across to the public, because we all want instant gratification.
Right, so, but look at the marketing effort that's going in creating these products. If we put a tenth of our effort and our time into marketing proper food in the same way, then we'd be fine. But the difficulty is the British economy would take an enormous great big hit, because there are these companies which are making an absolute fortune. Don't forget, Unilever's profit could feed the entire country. You could have a perfectly decent, survivable, balanced diet on 150 quid a year. It's food is crazily cheap. If man does not live by bread alone, but you can eat a whole 400 gram loaf of bread every single day, and the wheat in it costs you 20 quid. And that's family sized loaf of bread every day. And what happens is that the miller marks that wheat up by 500%. And then the baker marks that wheat up by 500%. It's nuts.
I have to say, when I make my own sourdough, and I worked out the cost of making my sourdough, this is using retail flour, so that's not getting back to yours. And it is, I think it's 60p, and they cost, don't they, 6 quid a loaf or 5 quid a loaf or something. So that, even that, buying supermarket flour is extraordinary, I think. Getting back to this, I love the way you approached your year. So you calculated the amount of calories you needed a day, which is about 2,500, and then you took it up to how many a year, and it's 1 million calories a year. And you planned beforehand. Obviously, you couldn't start from day one with no prep. You have to make sure everything was in order, so you had a true year. But one thing that I wasn't sure about, so you didn't buy any pig food, cattle food, chicken food, anything in that time, or did you buy in concentrates for them?
So only I was being food self-sufficient. The animals on my farm weren't being food self-sufficient. I mean, I did wind up feeding the pigs I had. I wound up feeding them a lot of waste vegetable products and an awful lot of waste from dairy. But I did buy in a bit of pig feed. I was buying in my chicken feed, although they were getting loads of scraps and dairy as well. My cow, Brenda, is a real diva, and she knows when she's being shortchanged. And so I did buy in a little bit of cow feed just to keep her happy and contented as well. In principle, it was only me being food self-sufficient, not my farm animals. But I did do my best to mitigate against that.
Yeah, I like the way you called your cow Brenda. So that was Private Eye's name, wasn't it, for the late queen? She was called
Brenda.
For
the late queen, yeah. her second calf, who was born during during my actual year of food self-sufficiency, her second calf was called Brian, because Private Eye used to call Prince Charles Brian.
Oh, yes, that's right. What amazes me is the time it takes. You know, I grow veg and stuff here, and I think the most time is spent picking, really. But how many hours a week did you spend growing, making and preparing a week?
a lot. I mean, more than a day's work every
day.
So
it's a good 37 and a half hours a week,
Yeah,
really.
totally.
Right.
Because everything's got to be cooked as well, and you've got to do all the planning, and they've got to, you've got to have the fences and all the rest of it. And at the end of the day, Bunny, I'm sure that you really, really know what you're doing, and you're growing very, very beautiful vegetables in a wonderfully well-organized garden. And I didn't do that. I was really up against it. The economy of scale of one person producing the food for one person for 1 year is just nuts.
Yeah.
And it's a hopeless economy of scale. I just divided an area about the size of two city allotments into four sections. One was potatoes, one was brassicas, one was roots, and the other was everything else. And I just had to keep a lid on it for 18 months, basically, and I just about managed it,
Yeah.
but I didn't stay on top of the weeds, absolutely not. And the second you don't, then you don't ruin things, but your productivity just plunges through the floor,
I mean,
because you're growing loads of stuff you can't eat.
and also, yeah, good point. And also, I mean, just the fact that when you were cutting the corn, you were cutting it with scissors, weren't they, almost? The
They were
head.
picking, yeah.
Yeah,
And the
picking.
difficulty was, as we were going to harvest our wheat in a traditional way by cutting it down with a scythe and then stacking it all up and everything. We didn't wind up doing that because so much of our wheat had been rolled over. The only way you could actually get it up off the ground was to pick each individual ear.
Yeah. And that was the badgers, you see. If you would, like, I had badgers, everyone has badgers, and I put the electric fence up and that stopped them, which you then discovered and did it. So, but the fact that you found it later meant you lost a huge amount of your wheat, which wasn't a great start. But I mean, that was extraordinary. And I thought that actually, if you do it like that, it does become quite boring, quite tedious. But when you dip in and out of it, like I do, I'm doing it, but it's not my main thing, then it's fun. That's the difference, isn't it, really?
I mean, I didn't ever find it boring, ever. Any
Oh, you
task
didn't.
or no, I didn't find it boring at all. Because it was keeping me alive. If I hadn't have eaten anything for a whole year, I would have died. And
Yeah.
it's a hell of a motive for doing things. Being hungry is really, really unpleasant.
Yeah.
And I was never bored because I was always doing something for an incredibly important purpose. That's what made the huge difference for me. No, I was never ever bored.
And so also, you saw a doctor regularly. She really thought this through, didn't she? And she checked you over. So did she notice any, or did you notice any difference in your mental health? Were you happier? Never bored, always occupied, and challenging. So did you feel happier?
Absolutely. Oh, what a lovely walk. Do you know what I mean? It was great.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed having a purpose. I thought I was going to lose lots of weight, and I lost a pound across the whole project. As William pointed out in our videos, just because you're producing your own food doesn't mean you're not going to eat too much of it and remain fat.
Yeah.
So that was hilarious.
And
I think
nutritionally?
I'm very lucky. I think I'm very lucky, despite being overweight. I think I'm very, very lucky that I don't have issues with cholesterol and stuff like that. So I was fine.
And nutritionally, you're fine. When your doctor checks you, I mean, I can't think why you wouldn't really. I can't think what your diet would miss,
No, I had my diet was fine. I mean, what was great was, I did feel I didn't have any E numbers for a whole year, Bunny. I mean, it was great. And I did feel very, very healthy. The one thing that was important is that I was constantly frustrated at not working hard enough and not getting enough done. And I suddenly realized that after the project had finished, what that was about, because it was very, very painful giving up tea and coffee. At the very beginning of the project, I had terrible headaches and it was really, really hard. But then after I'd given up tea and coffee, I thought I was pretty fine. I was okay without tea and coffee. And it was only after the project finished, and I had two whacking great cups of strong black coffee, that I realized how much of my productivity is caffeinated, because my work rate for running around the garden, sorting out the cows after the project finished, doubled, because so much of what I achieve in a day is down to coffee.
Yeah.
And I was exhausted so much of the time.
That was one thing I was going to ask, your energy levels. You see, I think caffeine is a wonderful boost, and I have three strong cups every morning, and it is meant to be healthy. It's full of fiber. I can never understand this, but it's rich in fiber.
Wow.
If you talk to Michael Mosley, and I think they've done a trial with nurses, and they find their depression, if you have coffee, it really alleviates depression. So in my book, I would never give up coffee. But your microbiome, I imagine, is pretty boosted up there, isn't it? Must have, with all the microbes from the leaves and your varied diet, although not as varied as a supermarket diet in a way, because you've got access to more different fruits and veg. So that must help. But no, I thought that was really interesting. This whole business of, you know, you go to these restaurants and they say it's all homegrown and that's their big thing. But actually, if you grow vegetables that are hand produced, i.e. you're not using tractors and it's just hand picked, it is not economical. I mean, Charles Dowding, on his plot, he I think he says he makes about 20k a year from growing vegetables. But then when he then is a big hit on YouTube, and he's making far more money from YouTube than the vegetable costs, so he pays someone else to do it because it makes financial sense. Likewise, you really, you've done this, which is fascinating, but your skill set is slightly different. And you will now go on and do it in a different way, won't you? You'll just major on what you grow well and efficiently on your plot.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I learned was that I've got very heavy clay. It's incredibly fertile, potentially, but it's very, very heavy clay. And what I discovered was that my little tiny farm, 5-acre farm, grows grass and trees brilliantly. And if you think about it, the food that Somerset's really famous for is cider and cheese, and my farm produces cider and cheese absolutely spectacularly. You've got to be lucky with the weather to be able to plough it up and produce a decent crop of wheat. If you are lucky, it does produce a decent crop of wheat. What it really struggles to do is produce a decent crop of vegetables, just because there's so much of the time you can't even walk on my ground, let alone put a spade in it. And it's a problem. So in the future, we've got a new project starting this September, where I'm clubbing together with a group of other local small farmers and food producers, and we're going to try and concentrate on what our ground's good for and what works well, and try and all of us be 100% food self-sufficient. And to that end, I'm contributing two things to our little group. We're called the Magna Barter, and we've got this new little group, and I'm contributing two things. I'm contributing the dairy, and I'm contributing the vino, because my vines grow very nicely, thanks very much, on my farm, and produce really nice wine, and I can produce terrific dairy. And that's what my farm work does well.
And I think that's a great idea.
If I concentrate hard on what my farm does well, my friend Andrew's got a lovely biodynamic small holding on the top of the hill up there above the Glastonbury Festival site. He's got very, very different soil. He can cultivate it in March, whereas I can't get on mine until, you know, the end of April at the earliest. It's much more free draining. He can grow terrific potatoes and cereals up there, whereas I'm really struggling to do those things.
So it's back to the sort of small cooperative. I think that's a really good idea. I mean, if I were you, I would have done raised beds, but that's how, you know, we did a garden in Inmarsh, and it was called Inmarsh because it was a marsh. And so we did raised beds, and that worked brilliantly. But you are obviously a better gardener now. If you did the year again, you would do it better. You might. What did you learn?
I would. Do you know what I'd do? do you know, as it sounds awful, but I, what I would have done different is I might not have done raised beds, but what I would have done, I think, is probably spray it all off before I started. I know that sounds like a hideous thing.
But no, I do had, that.
If I, yeah. I think that a good way to start with organic farming is to start with a clean slate. And I think that if you don't start with a clean slate and you start with, I mean, my farm that I, where I grew my vegetables, where I grew my wheat, that hadn't been ploughed since the war. And the weed burden in that pasture is absolutely giant. There are seeds in there that are decades and decades old. You turn it over, you bring them all to the surface, and they go, whoa, look at this. Yeah. And away they go. And I think I might have sprayed it off to start off with. I didn't do that.
Yeah, no, that's what I always do. If I'm starting a new plot, I'll just spray it with the glyphosate. I won't turn it over because it brings the seeds up, and I'll pit plant into the dead sward.
Yeah.
And it keeps that lovely top layer, that sort of 6 centimetres at top, full of the microbacteria and things like that that you want, the worms. You then add a mulch having sown or planted, and that doubles the worm content, whereas when you cultivate, you knock all that back.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really fortunate that one of the people in my group is an ancient, really well established community supported agriculture project, literally just down the road. They grow on, they've got very wet soil. I mean, it's peatier than much peatier than mine is, but they've got very very heavy conditions. They grow on raised beds. They have done for decades. It works absolutely brilliantly. And that's how to do it. And that is what William Cobbett was arguing about for London in his book 200 years ago. You know, I mean, William Cobbett said, London is being fed by market gardens in Kensington. And the idea that you can't produce all of the food that a family needs on a quarter of an acre is nonsense, because you know, the market gardens in Kensington and Southwark are producing the food for the whole of London in that way. And one of the things I want to do is just look at how you could upscale this. If you change the planning laws and you actually try to do it, could you feed Yeovil with market gardens around and in Yeovil? Could you feed Bristol with market gardens in and around Bristol, where everyone in the community is involved in producing food? It becomes part of their life. It becomes part of the thing that their communities are proud of, and it's very, very important to them. I'd love to do some, you know, be involved in doing some work on upscaling what you and I are talking about.
Oh, that's brilliant. And John Seymour used to say 12 square metres would feed a family, didn't he, from raised beds, because obviously they're highly productive and they're always in production. That's a fantastic thing. I'll be interested to hear about that. What I loved about watching your brilliant YouTube thing was that your relationships with your son, I mean, it looked great, because anyone knows who's got kids, they are the biggest leveler, aren't they? They really tell you as it is, and they teased you relentlessly, which I always think is really quite sort of healthy, but it can be tough at the time. But I did sense that they really admired you, and they were impressed with your achievements. They were, weren't they? You could see that. At the start, it was, oh, my God, he'll never do it, and you can't have the tomato ketchup, Dad. But they were all impressed. And your wife, was she? What did she think of you at the end of the year?
I think that Maxine's been amazingly generous to let me go off on this sort of ridiculous fantasy. I mean, what a gift to be able to give someone. I mean, she's just been so generous in letting me do that. I'm sure she'd much, much rather I had a job reading the 6 o'clock news on Radio 4, do you know what I mean, and just brought in a decent wage. And she has been so generous in letting me do this. The boys, look, I mean, my mum was such a huge influence on me, because she was brought up on a small holding during the war where they had to feed, you know, produce their own food. Her father was brought up during the First World War. His grandparents, small farmers in Scotland. I mean, there was unfinished business as far as me, my mum, my granddad, were concerned in this project. And the boys are kind of, the boys totally get it philosophically, what I was on about. Mm. We have a saying in our family, which is truth has nothing to do with being in the majority. And absolutely, you know, they vive la différence, you know, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, lovely. Also your brother, you see, one of your sons said that you and your brother Tim is as mad as my dad, he said, both desperate and driven in finding the truth. And that really is in, you were in politics before, but that really was a hard job to find the truth in politics, no doubt. but I find that whole relationship thing really good watching that. So your biggest disaster, can we have your biggest disaster and your biggest success with your production line?
My biggest disaster was my barley, which just got eaten by the rats. I stacked it all up in grape harvesting, one-ton grape harvesting boxes, thinking that it was like a barley mow, like an old-fashioned barley mow where they store the barley in the autumn and early winter and then thresh it all. By the time I got to sort of January, thinking, I quite like some beer, it had all been eaten by the rats. That was an absolute disaster.
So what I do with that, I sometimes put pig food and stuff in the barn. And so I put it up on a raised table. You know, if you have something with an overhang, so the mice and rats can't get up, that's the only way. Like the old stook, the grain stores.
Saddle stones. Saddle stones. Yeah.
Because they, I mean, the population of rats and mice, and we live next to a grain store, it just seems to have escalated over the years. And come autumn, they all race in when the combine. And that. So difficult. And what would you do next year then with that? How would you stop that? Do the saddle stone thing or table or cantilever of some sort?
I'd harvest it with a combine harvester.
You'd still get rats. They have them in there.
Yeah. But what worked well was when I was storing grain, worked really well was I stored it in bins and nets hanging from the ceiling in a stable. And that worked really well. I think I wouldn't be worrying too much about drying grain or keeping it dry if I combined it, because I think that's an easier problem to solve. So I'd do that. And in fact, the Magna Barta, our new thing, we've grown a big chunk of wheat, maybe 5 tons of wheat, and we're currently trying to buy a 1950s combine harvester to harvest our wheat for. Which we're growing at the moment.
Well, if you
that was my biggest disaster. My biggest success was absolutely cheese making. I've really got into making cheese. I make really good cheddar now. I really do.
Do cheddar, a blue, and a soft cheese.
Blue and a soft, yeah. And what a stunning product it is. You know, we take raw milk, and
that is the
in
big
6 months or a year.
It?
You're making something so spectacular. That's I'm so proud of it. And I think that, you know, when I read John Seymour's Complete Self-Sufficiency as a 10-year-old, I think that I was most bewitched by the idea of making my own cheddar and stuff. And I've done it, and I'm really good at it. And I really get a sense of achievement out of it. So that's been my biggest success,
And to be able to do it with raw, unpasteurised milk, obviously you get a faster rate of maturing, you get a much better taste. And the whole thing about unpasteurised milk, I just love. But obviously people are careful about it for very obvious reasons. But I thought you were going to say your rosé wine, because I was talking to someone who stocks it in their shop. And she was eulogising a bit about it and saying what wonderful stuff it was. So that is another big success, isn't it, your rosé?
It is, yeah. I mean, look,
Chateau Max. What is it
Chateau
called?
Chateau Max. I mean, it's my rosé. It's a Provençal style rosé. No one believes it's made in England. It's you know, it tastes like it's straight out of Provence. My rosé, and it is absolutely stunning. The difficulty is I only grow it, and the total, you know, amazingness of my wine. I think comes from a wonderful guy called Steve Brooksbank in a neighbouring village who turns my grapes into spectacular rosé. And I know that I'm allowed to say I make the wine because I grow the grapes, but dear old Steve does a stunning job making, making my wine. So,
And he makes it sort of organically. He doesn't add in all these sulfites and things like
that. No, it does. If you make natural wine, is clearly wonderful, but it turns to vinegar unbelievably quickly and easily. And so a little bit of sulfite makes an enormous difference. You know, you can't add bacon without sulfites. It doesn't really exist. You can chuck some salt at it, but it's grey and it doesn't keep terribly well. And it's very, very hard to make the wine we've got used to drinking without the addition of some chemicals. But I'm not a proper wine bod. You know, I mean, I don't really know about these things. But when I have made wine without sulfites, it turns to vinegar really fast.
Right, interesting. I was impressed that you made your own vinegar as well.
That was easy peasy. I just took my wine, which had sulfites in it. I knocked the sulfites in it with a little dash of hydrogen peroxide. It then went to vinegar and then developed this wonderful vinegar mother in it, this great big rubbery, splodgy octopus thing in the bottom of the jar. And then you just keep on adding wine, and it just makes more and more vinegar. Wonderful stuff.
And the wine is ordinary wine, your ordinary wine. You don't add more hydrogen peroxide. Once you've got the mother, you just add ordinary wine.
Then I was just adding ordinary wine. For some reason, it'll still go with the tiny amount of sulfites that are in the wine. You can't start off with sulfites, but I was just pouring wine with sulfites in it into the vinegar mother, and it was fine.
Because when people make their own balsamic vinegar, I've had that, and it is just tremendous. And when you think what you buy...
What is balsamic vinegar? How do you make... Because I want to be able to make that. What is it?
I think you have to get the mother. I'm not sure what it is, but that's one of my projects I've got for the future, is making balsamic vinegar. And it is... You can make
it. Where does that caramelisey kind of thing in balsamic vinegar come from?
I imagine it's the fermenting. I imagine it ferments and it's slightly sweet, and that's what causes it. But I'm sure if you go on YouTube, you can find out.
I'm sure,
I really admired of your thing was the fact that you had your cow, Brenda, and you shared the milk with the calf, because we have cows and we use them for beef. And when I looked at the calorific value, you said Brenda churned out, was it 2 million calories a year or something?
Three million
from one dairy cow. That is amazing. And when I looked at the calorific value of me slaughtering one of my bullocks, the edible meat was only 1 million. But the thing
it's less than that. A modern dairy cow is producing 7-8 million calories a year. And a big fat bullock, a big 400 kilo on the hook bullock, is 758 calories by my thousand calories by my calculation. Yeah, dairy is, if we want to produce protein from British farms off grass, dairy is the way to go. Talk to Simon Fairley, amazing guy, stunning guy, real pioneer in terms of the politics of food production in Britain and how it should be. Great guy, Simon Fairley. Dairy is the way to go. And it's so unfortunate that we're being constantly steered away from dairy. Dairy is the way to produce protein in Britain.
But what I've always wanted to do, but it's time thing, is have a cow and a calf, and you share the milk rather than having to rip the calf away. They're usually slaughtered, aren't they? Because we have so many bull calves, and it just seems so unfair. But obviously, my Dexters aren't as tame as Brenda. You hand reared Brenda, I think, haven't you? So she's a tame, but
they don't have to be hand-reared. It's just that it's just because you're handling them every single day, they get very, very tame.
Yeah, my Dexters, I think they'd sort me out if I tried to milk them with their calves. Anyway, so it's been fascinating to talk to you. I've learned a lot, I really have, and I think it was an amazing, amazing thing that you did. And you must be feeling pleased with yourself. So now you're going to go on and do the Magna Barter,
yeah.
And that's going to be your main thing, or you're not doing any other things you're starting up? Or
no, I mean, I do work. I drive a school bus 18 hours a week
for cash.
and do various other bits and pieces. But these projects, the new one, they really are, you know, they take over in a wonderful way. So I'm quite looking forward to getting back into it in September. I really am. Yeah.
Oh, I see. You're starting the Magna Barta from September.
Yes.
And you're going to document it. Are we doing YouTube?
Well, I'll find out in about 2 weeks' time. But I hope that the BBC are going to commission another series of Growing Solo to cover the Magna Barta, which would be marvellous.
As a radio programme?
As a radio programme, yeah.
As a radio programme, right, yeah. Okay. What I think you should do, Max, is you should do it like some of the chefs did. You should get other people to do it with you, other groups, so that you encourage the country to do this and you help us along our way, because I would love to do that. I think that would be really nice to get people in your area that one could grow this, one could grow that and do it. I mean, you could develop it, roll it out across the country, Max.
That would be great.
In Holland, there's a town in Holland, isn't it? I'm just trying to remember the name, but beginning with A. And they, instead of growing cotoneasters and all these sort of shrubs in those municipal plantings you have around the town, they grow grapevines or they grow tomatoes and things like that. And people can just go and pick them as they like and tend them.
Let's just see if we can get the Magna Barta to work. This is, no one pays any money for any food at all. We just swap what we produce with each other. And I want to try and get that working and then see if we can introduce the idea of people who aren't food producers to come and be involved in the same way as you would with the community supported agriculture project where people come in, they do some labour and they get some food. You know, I think it's great.
Yeah, lovely. Well, best of luck with all your projects. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
I'll be looking out avidly for that because I think it sounds great. Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.